Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Commercial Property Investor Podcast, where it's my job to introduce you to people from the world of commercial property. We're talking with investors and thought leaders about their experiences of the commercial property world and sharing our own lessons from the last 20 years to give you practical know-how so that you can follow in their footsteps. If you've ever thought commercial could be your next step, but it just seems too confusing and opaque, then you've come to the right place. There are so many exciting opportunities in this dynamic sector, and I'm looking forward to pulling back the curtain and sharing them with you. Welcome to the Commercial Property Investor Podcast, the show dedicated to the private investor, and I'm your host, Jerry Alexander. We want to show you how to cross the divide from residential investing over to commercial property investing. Through interviews, tips and lessons learned, we share experiences of investing and give you the inspiration, knowledge and confidence to enjoy this great cash flowing strategy. So let's get started. Welcome back to the Commercial Property Investor Podcast. I'm so pleased to have Danny Inman on the line. Danny, hi.
Hi, how are you, Jerry? You good?
Yeah, I'm great. It's super to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us. I wanted to start off, Danny, with a when, a how, and a why property question for you, right? In a reasonably short period of time, just let us know when you got involved, why, and really how. Where did it start for you?
Oh, God. So when 2008, 2009, just so literally... as the world had apparently ended the last time the world had apparently ended, because obviously we're entering into that current world ending cycle now. But 2008, 2009, entirely accidentally, I was sent as a plus one on one of the world famous property seminars. I was somebody's plus one sent to a training course at the time, a bit of a crossroads in my life. I was a professional rugby league player as a junior and was supposed to go on to do great things in that, and then very, very quickly realized that wasn't going to be my career. Then I went to university, did an advanced maths and civil engineering degree, and I was doing well in that and realized that wasn't going to be my career. So that was the crossroads, basically. I got sent as a plus one at a very strange point in my life where I was delivering Chinese takeaways, trying to decide what I was going to do. It was a plus one at a property education seminar in 2000. It was November 2009 or November 2008. I always get those dates mixed up. It was one of those dates, but definitely around the 2008-2009 period. So not far off 15 years now.
Wow.
Yeah. And the why? That was why the questions?
Yeah.
I had nothing better to do. It was the honest answer. I wish I had a big emotional drive and a big amount. I had no idea that I was going to like property. I knew very little about property. I knew parents had a mortgage. They paid for it. That was kind of my extent of knowledge of property. I had rented a property as a student. I thought the landlord must be doing okay. But other than that, no idea. Genuinely no idea. So it's not a... It's not a genetic thing. It's not an inherited thing. It's complete accident that's turned out all right.
I'm going to just go a little bit further on the why. That's obviously changed now, I assume. And are you, it's interesting because some people believe and almost hold themselves back that they must have an awesome why. Otherwise, what's the point? Are you in the camp of, yeah, you need to absolutely know why you're doing this, or just get on and figure out as you go along? What's your sort of viewpoint on that? And do you have a huge, enormous why now, or are you just enjoying it all?
No, I think people's whys change, and I think people put so much focus on their why, they ignore the how. I think that happens so much. Like, I've got to do really well, and they put this massive pressure because of my kids, my family, my background, blah, blah, blah. And then it creates all of the focus is on the why and not on how I'm actually going to do it. It's probably served me well to not really have this huge emotional driven why that I think for some people creates a distraction. I think other people's whys change. When I got into it at 22, I think I was at the time, it was literally just monetary. It was I know people make money out of property. I'm hearing these big numbers. I'm a young kid. I see this guy's driving a nice car. I want a piece of that. And everything shallow that kind of you could possibly exist, that people probably 22 and now looking at me thinking the same shallow thoughts that I thought back then. I still don't have a huge why other than I really enjoy it. Like I absolutely love the game. I think I treat it as a game. I don't take anything that seriously. I want to fulfill my potential, and ultimately I think we all die not fulfilling our potential, and it's that striving to be consistently better that's kind of kept me going. But no, I don't have family. I don't have a huge sob story about, like anyone. I've had some struggles as a kid and in my life, but none of that is really leverage as to why I'm doing what I want to do. I just think I've got a bit of a skill and I have an obligation to utilize that skill to the best of my ability to realize my fullest potential. And that's kind of it, really.
Okay. I try not to do this, but I'm going to go on another detour, right? Because just before we started recording this, we were talking about the fact that you're living this kind of offshore living lifestyle and you're investing onshore. And part of the thing that you mentioned about the environment you're in right now, and maybe you can tell us where you are, but the environment is the conditioning around you. And you're talking there about not necessarily having a huge dream. And often people talk about that because their environment is such not a negative, but a difficult place that they're being challenged all the time and they forget why they're doing it altogether.
Yeah.
And you're in kind of a different place, really, aren't you? Just tell us A, where you are, and also why you feel that environment slightly different and how it's helping you.
I'm in Dubai at the minute. We spend about 4 or 5 months of the year here. A few reasons, obviously, business opportunity. There's phenomenal amount of interest in the UK property market from people out here. There's a lot of expats who want to invest in the UK property market because they feel there's a safe connection with investing at home and they're earning good tax-free money in this place. We originally started coming out here on holiday. I thought it was underpriced as an investment area. So that was the only reason we bought at the start, was literally you look at this as a major city and what it had planned and the tourism that was here, and you compared the prices to London, Hong Kong, Singapore, it was a third of the price for prime real estate. So I literally just thought it's cheap in commas for those that are listening and not watching. It's comparatively cheap and it would make sense as an investment. And that's paid off since COVID here. Our unit that we bought is probably up 50% in value, and Dubai is absolutely flying. A lot of very successful people are flocking here, and I'm spending more time here for the reasons we discussed just before we started. There's just a different mindset here. There's very little entitlement. Obviously, without going too political, there's an autocracy over a democracy. But I've seen the benefits of that and felt the benefits of that even spending half of the year here, that you don't hear a lot of negative news. There's not a lot of negativity. That doesn't mean negative things don't happen. It's just that it's not thrown in your face all day. Everybody that's here is generally quite entrepreneurial, or they have ambition. They've come here for a purpose. And that's from every level, from workers at entry level to multi-multi-millionaires that move here. They've moved here for a reason. They want to come here to change their environment or to earn more money than they can in their own location. So it's just a very, very different mindset. And I spend half of my year in the UK, but a lot of my time is spent adapting to the mindsets of each country that I'm in at the time. The transition is the toughest part. It's very, very tough to go to a place off, go from a place where you hear no news, no real negativity. You know, people are quite ambitious. They want to chat with you, to go back to the UK where it's absolutely thrown in your face. Everybody's kind of struggling. They want to tell you they're struggling. You know, it's kind of a case of who's worse off, and they want to debate who's worse off. And a lot of people are waiting to be given a solution. You know, that transition has been tough. First world problem, I'm aware, but I spend a lot of my time trying to transition, and my mind's going, you know, I have to adapt to where I am now. So yeah, it's interesting. It's definitely interesting.
So that conditioning, though, is really helping with you. For obviously, you come back here, and we're going to go on to a specific project in a minute, but you come back here to work on projects, to work with your team, and you know, you have a good network of people that you work with in terms of education.
Yeah.
But you then go back there for, I guess, some better conditioning, some yeah. relaxation, but also just meeting some other people that are ambitious again.
I think by nature, entrepreneurs, we're weirdos. Like I say a lot, we are strange people. Like, we're not the norm. But then going back into the UK, I feel like an even bigger weirdo because of the you know, the separation now between my mindset and the general public mindset in the UK at the moment is just, it's miles apart. And I didn't experience COVID probably the same way as a lot of people in the UK did, because we managed to get out during lockdowns and we weren't having those one-on-one discussions with people going, oh, this is terrible, isn't that terrible, they've got COVID, you know. So yeah, it, like, relatively COVID was okay for us. It sounds horrible to say it, but it was all right, because I got out of an environment that allowed itself to struggle and into an environment where they were aware of it, but it was kind of like, life's got to carry on and we're going to do what we're going to do kind of thing. So
different, very different. Right, okay, let's talk about a specific project, because Danny, you and I'm throwing some time in here, right? You've basically yeah. spent your time doing residential, central kind of part of the UK, and then you've started moving on to this model of buying older commercial property and converting them into apart hotels.
Mm.
Yep, is that a fair summary? You yeah, feel the details missed out there, but
across the 14 years, yeah, started off sourcing, then started buying little stuff, then went into social housing in a reasonable way, then we went into HMOs in a big way. We had 350 HMO rooms at our peak. Sort of scaled that back when we started to move into conversion. We became conversion specialists, going from commercial to resi.
Yeah.
Now we're doing a lot of mixed use or purely commercial, with the biggest part, our biggest ambition of our purely commercial probably being the apart hotel model that we're hoping to really push on with.
Yeah, so for you, really being the tenant, effectively. So you, I'm assuming, and this is maybe the wrong thing to do, but I'm assuming that your apart hotel operating side is a separate business, and that effectively yeah, it's becoming a tenant.
We want to be both ultimately. So we're going to be building owner, probably McDonald's method to a degree. We want to be building owner and operator, knowing that long-term wealth is coming from being building owner, and income and performance is coming from being an operator. So, that's kind of where we're at. And that's the current model we're running. We've had some incredible offers for other people to operate on our sites, but we think our model can work, and we want it to work, and we want to be operator and business owners, building owner, sorry, as well.
Yeah, great. That's excellent. I mean, that's kind of the, I guess that's the path we take, in that we have the real money at the end of the day, like you say, the wealth is actually holding the property, doing the redevelopment, doing the adjustment on the income, and the values held in there. But the operating business gives you so much better margin as you're going along, doesn't it?
100%. Yeah.
So let's just talk specifically about this project you have effectively just finished. I think you've just finished the post about office. Tell us where we're at.
So we've got a couple of listed building challenges, as I'm sure anyone dealing with listed building will be historically aware of. So we've just got a couple of listed building things to finish, and then we're at furnishing and final finishes stage now. We've just employed our operations manager to take over, because principally, I mean, we're property guys, so we're acutely aware of our lack of knowledge and our lack of experience in delivering hospitality. So usually when something's a weakness, we try and delegate as quickly as possible rather than learn it all ourselves. So we've got an employed a guy who's showing excellent character. He ran 9 Premier Inns in the locality. So he has a multi-site experience, which was important for us because we want to scale and we want that multi-site. We're at that stage. We're hopefully mid-October, we're going to be fully open and fully operational. Because everything has lead times and everything seems to depend on everything else. The management system depends on your website. Your website depends on your relationship with the OTAs, and everything's just taking time and is interconnected. And because we're property guys, we want to employ and get them to take that on over us doing it, really.
Yeah, it's fine. Somebody with a smart brain that can work all that stuff, because it's so intertangled, isn't it? Just give us a summary of that project, though, Danny. It's formerly a post office. Can you maybe just give us a couple of stats, maybe the size, where it is?
Yeah. So there's ground floor restaurant and bar, two separate businesses. The restaurant was sold off before our ownership on long leasehold. The bar is still under our freehold. The bar pays 30,000 a rent, has an independent value of 400,000 as a standalone. They combined about 5,000 feet on the ground floor, and then it's a double, basically. So we've got about 11,000 feet across the two upper floors. We are putting 21 self-contained apart hotel units in there. We did that slightly different in Scotland, but we've got C1 use class, which is hotel hospitality use class. So we've done it under C1. A lot of people do it under C3 and try and get a bricks and mortar valuation, i.e. what is the apartment worth in its own right. By doing it under C1, which is hotel valuation, your valuation is purely then based on the income rather than on what the bricks and mortar of the apartments would be. Gives you a bit more flexibility as well, because you can have smaller units. So if you're doing residential units, there's minimum space standards of 40 square meters, 50 square meters, 60 square, depending upon the size and the area. There's no minimum space standards in a C1 development. So we managed to get more units of smaller, the average 25 to 30 square meters in there. And then based on their income valuation, those 25, 30 square meter units actually have a higher value than they would have if they were 45, 50, 60 square meter bricks and mortar apartments. So it made sense for us to approach it that way.
And how did you find the planning process for that? Because it's a listed building, right?
Yeah, obviously you've got the two applications that run side by side with your listed building consent and planning consent, and sometimes getting those guys to agree. Challenge. Sometimes heritage can be a dream, albeit rarely, and planning can be a challenge, and then sometimes planning can be okay and a heritage department can give you a hell. They want you plastering horsehair and shit on the wall just to match what was there 150 years ago. And you know, sometimes heritage departments make developing a listed building a challenge, which is why we're losing some listed buildings, because it's just not cost effective for a developer to come in and build them out the way that they're insisting on them being built. This site was all right, but by heritage standards, I think it's such a feature building and such a prime location in Warrington. I joke and call Warrington the Chelsea of the North. It's definitely not the Chelsea of the North. That's very tongue-in-cheek whenever I say it, but it is a very high quality town, fast developing, lots of investment, and this part of the town is a very feature part of the town. So they wanted something done with it, and for too long something hadn't been done with it, and I think it fits into the remit, bringing people from outside the town into the town center, into a part of the area where they really want to develop and invest, and you know, I think it had a value to them to get this done with it. And I think that's sometimes part of the play, isn't it? I think if you can sell the dream to the council, it has a value.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you. Yeah, you spend quite a lot of time up front with the design team to make sure when that application goes in, it's touching all those buttons that you've researched and find they're looking for.
Yeah, planning is the biggest problem in UK property. There's no hiding behind that fact. And I think it's now got to the point where planning departments don't even hide behind that fact themselves. They know that they are a problem. They can't recruit. People in that job are generally motivated the wrong way. They try and find reasons to refuse rather than to give approval. You know, there's so much wrong with planning policy that actually isn't always the planning department's fault. They're following the wrong policy, a policy that doesn't work for development. But yeah, it helps. If you can sell them a dream and you've got people in high enough places in the town, whether that's local MP, mayor, you know, local person responsible for commercial development or whoever it may be, if you can get them on board and try and sell the dream that, listen, we are wanting to put money into this town. On that development, we've spent 2 million quid on improving an empty listed building, bringing it into operation, bringing potentially 100 people a week from outside the town into the town centre, you know, helping local economy, local hospitality and all of that. If you can sell them that dream, that should have a value to them. And usually it does, you know, usually they see sense. I think it had a value to us to kind of really sell them that dream. It's the new thing for Warrington and it was a new thing for the planners. So to be honest, I don't really think they knew how to make some of the decisions based on what it was going to be. They didn't understand our model is completely off-site. So we're doing high-tech keyless entry. So QR codes sent on booking. We're using Salto key systems, which basically means everything can be programmed remotely. And it blew a very old school council's mind. What do you mean? You've got no reception. You've got no staff on site. What does this mean? And they had no idea really on that model. And we had to show them city centre, like Manchester, London models, where this is the same thing. You know, it's exactly, you know, it's very, very common. This is just not common in Warrington yet. Yeah. So yeah, it took a bit of work, a lot of work actually. Planning's slow anyway, and it was slower, even slower trying to explain a new model to an old school council, probably with planning officers that were changing every 6 months, and then COVID hit and people were working from home and not working that effectively, or someone went off sick and then they went on holiday. It's just, you know what planning's like. It's by far our biggest challenge.
A lot of people would give up. I mean, did you take an option on this? Did you buy it outright at the start of the process?
No, we bought it. We bought it immediately. And to be honest, to be brutally honest, because it's my way, we didn't buy it with the apart hotel model in mind. When we first bought it, we went, that is a cracking building in a great location. It's huge and I can get it cheap. And that was
work out like, what to use it for later.
And we it kind of always worked for us. Everybody wants to perfect that kind of scenario. But we had a very short time frame because it had been repossessed and we were getting it direct from the bank. We had a very short time frame to get this done. And our judgment just needed to be, do we see potential in this site? You know, it already had 40, 50 grand worth of income anyway, yeah. Rental income. So it's like, do we see potential in this site beyond what it is currently? And I could sell that building. Well, we built it now, but I could have sold it without planning today, probably double what we paid. We paid 550 at the time. And I'd have been pretty confident we'd have got a million to 1.1 million had we not done anything 4 or 5 years down the line.
So you've spent 2 million on it.
Well, we're all in for about 2.55.
Yeah. So buying price, yes. Yeah. So about two mil on fitting it out, never hang.
Yeah. And GDV is 2.7. Okay. So we've had a GDV value, which we think is a bit light. Didn't really bother contesting it. They gave us a commercial valuation just on the pub element. So on the 30 grand a year pub rental that we now have. They gave us a valuation of 400 grand, which I think is about 8% yield roughly from memory. And then the upper floors, they did, without getting too technical, they did an EBITDA. EBITDA? I always get that wrong.
EBITDA.
Yeah. Earnings before interest, deductions, tax, and such.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. So they did an EBITDA, which basically is your net income after all deductions times a multiple. A yield multiple in the area. So they did a multiple of 9x net income, basically, for ease of use.
But let's be fair, that net income was partially pulled out of the air because it doesn't exist right now.
Yeah. And so, we had to present comparables and a case, local hotels, what are they achieving? What's their occupancy rate? How does their square footage and spec compare to ours? That's why we think they've been a little bit harsh on Valve, because they've compared us to
Apples
probably the
oranges.
Best hotel in probably the best hotel in the area, to be honest. But it's just a standard. Here's a double room. We are fully self-contained, high tech, high, very high spec, considerably higher spec than them. We think we'll get a lot of longer stays, which will reduce our void periods because of the nature of of the model of what we're doing. So we think they've been a bit harsh, but
they've given you the number you needed.
It's got to where we needed to be. Yeah. So,
and where do you think your break even on that is in terms of occupancy, your sort of percentage occupancy?
We would break even at less than 50% occupancy.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Okay.
Because the rates are good, and there's a lot of, I mean, 21 is not a lot of units, but it's a reasonable amount of units to get a reasonable amount of income. So our gross income, just working from my head here, I looked at this morning, it's about 760,000 on that one building. And the EBITDA's roughly taken on about between 35 and 40% of that net income, basically.
Okay. Fantastic. There's a couple of other bits I need to ask. One is just finance of this project. You know, for some people, that's a lot of numbers. For others, maybe not so. But just talk us through maybe just some of the different tranches that you've done there. I mean, you know, be as open as you wish, or, you know, I mean, obviously.
Yeah. It's changed over time.
I haven't prepped you on that.
Yeah. So first of all, when we bought it, because we bought this in 2016, it might be 17.
Yeah.
But it's either 5 or 6 years ago. So the first period, we weren't really doing much with it. We occupied an element of it. We kept the ground floor as the tenant as it already was. And we got a term loan with RBS.
Yeah.
So straight away, because it was effectively owner-occupied, they gave us an RBS term loan. We operated that, I think, so it would have been 5 years. So yeah, it would be 6 years ago. So we had that term loan for 5 years. So the first couple of years, we just ran it as it was. We occupied a little bit of it. We were making decisions on what we were going to do. We were going to do a resi scheme, first of all. That was the first plan. And then a couple of years down the line, we thought, right, let's have a look at this apart hotel model. We stayed on the RBS loan. We put our planning in for the apart hotel model. It's fine. We're not actually doing anything yet. We're just applying for planning for what we're going to do at some point in the future. Planning eventually got approved, smack bang in the middle of COVID, after a couple of years of heavy debate and provability and probably educating the council on what actually this is going to be. We got planning approved. It was 2020 it was the middle of COVID, so just as COVID hit. So it was like March, April 2020. I remember walking around my garden on the phone to the planning officer who said, we're about to approve planning. They tried to add a couple of weird conditions that made no sense, and we had to argue. And then as soon as we were about to develop it, we moved off the RBS term loan to development finance, basically. Together, we do a lot of our finance with Together Finance. We're one of their biggest corporate clients because we do a lot of our lending with them. So development finance, X percent of the purchase, which was already covered anyway, we basically part the deposit for a period of time. So they just swapped out for RBS. And then it was 100% of the build, but in arrears, basically.
Yeah. Okay, that's cool. Right. So the RBS, I use the RBS. And so you basically, you've leveraged the income that's coming off the other and the owner, the business itself, your own business moving in. Yeah, it's a great way to get property at high street lending rather than going to second tier, if you can do that. Yeah. Okay, excellent. And then I just want to jump back to a detail you said. You mentioned Salto locks.
Yeah.
Just a technical thing, right? But it's quite important, that locking stuff. And it's the same for us. And we've gone down the Salto route as well. I think it's Salto KS we use.
Yeah.
And it integrates with our software management so that our, like you say, if somebody books something, it can do the necessary things that people need for their phone or whatever to access. But did you look at lots of different locks? How did you come to Salto? Had you used them before?
Anything that's a weakness, we delegate, Jerry. I didn't spend a lot of time, you know, for us, time's money. So if I spend 3 weeks looking at a lock to save a grand, it's probably cost me $5,000 to save a grand. So we went out to the market and to a security guy, to be honest, the guy who does all of our CCTV and a lot of our on-site security, and basically said to him, what is the best remote operated lock where we'll have nobody on site? What's the best one you can recommend to use? And he basically said Salto is not the cheapest, but it's the most integratable. It's consistent. It's good quality. The blocks look good. They'll always work. The tech is good. Because there's cheaper options. And a couple of people have come to me and gone, oh, you've gone with Salto. I can get you a such and such for half the price. And then you speak to somebody else who's got such and such, and they go, oh, yeah, but it breaks down every 3 weeks.
It's the integration as well. You need integration with other stuff, your other processes.
Yeah, yeah. So for us, it was literally, what is the best for what this model is going to be?
Yeah.
And you know, price plays a consideration, but it's probably less of a consideration that you don't want to put in a shit lock and in 6 months' time you're having to replace it and reintegrate a whole thing again. It's cost you money and time.
Oh, so, they're not inexpensive.
It wasn't that bad. I think across the 21, we're probably in for about $1,000 a lock.
Yeah.
It's all right.
Gives you the freedom. Right. Okay. So I just want to ask that from a personal point of view, because we've, been looking at different ones, and that's where we settled. It sounds like we settled on the right one. A couple other questions then. You have this balance of offshore living, onshore investing. How do you deal with that? Is it good people? What lots of Avios miles? what is it you do?
Yeah, a real mix. How we travel so much is definitely Avios miles. We play the Avios game probably nobody else I've ever seen. We'll earn between 2 and 2.5 million Avios a year in a very combined way of spending a lot, utilizing cards a lot, referring a lot, card for me, card for my missus. We play the game as aggressively as anyone I've seen. So that definitely helps to travel a lot, because I'm northern and tight. Well, I like to travel in a nice class, and I think I wouldn't travel as much if I had to pay full price for business class every time I was intending to travel. So that's a very honest approach. But I mean, logistically, as the business, I'm incredibly fortunate to have a business partner who probably, in my opinion, takes on the most painful part of being a developer, and that's the actual developing.
Yep.
I have zero involvement in construction, like little or none. I joke a lot about, you were seeing on my memes on social media about how little I'm on site and how sometimes they're talking on site and I'm just like, I don't know what's going on here. I'm a big believer in knowing what you need to know, knowing your strengths and kind of sticking to them. I'm very good at raising money. I'm okay at marketing. I'm good at closing deals. So deals get brought to me quite a lot. Everything else, I kind of go, someone else needs to be better at that. Unfortunately, those three roles that I said I'm reasonable at, they can all be done remotely and don't rely upon me on site. So very lucky to have a business partner, who then has, 150 plus guys, full-time, part-time contractors, subcontractors, who are doing a good job for him. He's built up a good team. He's got good senior managers in place now. It's just a proper operation that I'm very fortunate I somehow have weaned my way into, and I have to bring my value in a different way that doesn't rely upon me being there. So, yeah, delegation is everything to me. I think that's probably describes how I can get away so much.
Just current market. I know you've through your own social media posts, and we'll come on to social media a little bit later on. But in your own posts, a sense. A frustration at where mindset is at the moment. And we touched on that a little bit earlier on about media itself, the main media. What's your opinion on current market conditions, the reality of the current market rather than the trough, and where you think things are potentially going?
Probably the one thing that features most on my social media. I think I'm a bit too caveman to be anything but very logical. So I'm fortunate, and unless you speak to my missus, I'm very fortunate that I don't carry that much emotion with me anywhere. My missus tells me she's not very fortunate that I don't carry that much emotion. I'm highly unemotional, very logical, and fairly pragmatic, and it's always served me quite well to stay reasoned. So when COVID hit and everybody was saying, this is the end, it was like looking at things, you know, the three pillars, supply, demand, availability of finance, none of that pointed to the fact that the property market was going to dump. And for the first 6 months when everybody was saying it's going to dump, I was sat there going, I can't even see, even to the point where we had discussions with Together who were panicking in some of their behaviours, saying, this is your opportunity, if anything. It's an opportunity for you guys to really stand up and go, no, we're going to back you in this market. And eventually they did. They came round, but it took them 6 to 8 weeks. We never bought into the hype at that time. You know, now looking at it practical on where we are today, it's slowing, but it's not slow. Like the thing I always say, relativity matters. And when people are becoming emotional and hyped up, they always forget to be like, to have relativity. Yes, it's slowing now, but it's still higher than the five-year average by a long, long way, as in demand is still higher. It's 40% up on, you know, pre-2019. We're 40% up on what the market was like then, and nobody was making any noise about the market then. So I think a lot of the times, recession is the natural part of an economic cycle. And after you've had a period of relative ease, which is, you speak to everybody in the UK at the minute and they don't think they've had an easy period because COVID was challenging and all of that. But actually, if you look at things logically, it was relatively easy. A lot of you got paid 80% of your earnings for doing no work. A lot of the work that you actually did was under a lot less pressure because COVID was being leveraged as an excuse. So service standards dropped, time off was more acceptable. You know, you look at everything in the UK, it's actually been a relatively easy time on pressure to deliver. And then as soon as you're getting paid for an easy time for a period, that creates inflation. And then the only way to end inflation is with a recession. We are going into a recession. There's absolutely no doubt about it. In a non-emotional way, it's the only way that you end an inflationary period. It's the only way. There's no other alternative in reality. You can't buy your way out of a period of inflation. So
we got ourselves into it by buying our way out of another situation.
And they're doing it now. They're going to give more handouts for utilities and this and that. And, you know, obviously there's politics in play. And I look at things a lot of the time and go, well, that's politics. It's not economy. Like even now with the utility costs going up, I did a video this morning on inflation. And you know, if you look at petrol is £1.20. It flew to £2. Everybody was up in arms. It dropped to £1.70 and everyone's gone, oh, that's okay. It's dropped. And you go, well, actually, you know, you've still been wallowed by inflation. Yeah. But you're looking at relativity wrong there. And that's what they'll do with housing. Housing, will there will be a correction eventually in housing, but the correction will be smaller than the gain that we've had. But everybody will focus on the correction because they'll look at relativity wrong there. They'll look at relativity in an emotional way there. And you can see it coming. And, you know, since COVID hit, I thought that we would go up 20% and we would crack 10. You know, we've probably gone up 25, we might correct 10 to 15, but it will still drop to a level that's still higher than we went into COVID.
It's all relative, isn't it? And I guess if you've got in the last year or two, then you're maybe in a weaker position but it's being consistent over time is the key to all
time
this.
Time is your friend. Time is your friend. In property, time is your friend. And, you know, it's spending time in the market and timing the market are probably equally important. But spending time in the market is actually easier than timing the market. Yeah. But a lot of people forget it. You know, everybody talks about 2008 where the drop was 18%, wasn't it? And everybody talks about it like it was the end of the world. But the guys that got burnt the most were the guys that bought at high LTVs, bought at the peak of the market, and then had to sell at the bottom of the market. Most of the guys that managed to ride it out in most areas, you know, it had recovered by half within the first year after that 18 months where it had dropped to 18%. You know, it's not investors that get burned most of the time. It's actually residential buyers because they're the ones that took out 95% loan-to-value mortgages and, you know, they've not got that much fat. And then they're the ones that emotionally have to sell because of separation or financial position or moving for jobs or whatever it may be. So unfortunately, when the market changes, it's Joe Bloggs that ends up paying for it.
It can be, yeah. The other factor, of course, is you're not entire. Well, you could say it's predictable, but the way institutions respond. And if, for instance, if you're on commercial mortgages, and an institution decides either A, they've got too much exposure to a certain market, or B, we need revaluations because everything's based on a multiple. Yeah. We think nobody's in this market, so we need a new revaluation. And that's when 2008 and 9, where people were nothing changed. The income was the same. The tenant was still there. The loan to value was the bit that changed. But in terms of the actual income and the expenditure, nothing changed. But a lot of these properties got taken back at that time because the institutions decided that's what they needed to do.
Very interesting. I've actually started to hear of a couple of cases, and I actually strongly believe that that's the next big PPI type claim. Because a lot of banks misbehaved at that point, and they weren't actually taking back portfolios they probably should have. They were taking back ones with nice chunky bits of fat that kind of balanced their book. And I know of a case of somebody very locally to me who's just claimed several million pounds from a bank who repossessed something that they probably shouldn't have at that point in time. And I think that's coming like the wind. And I actually think I argue against democracy sometimes because I do think it creates a level of entitlement. But I actually think that's democracy working in our favour, really, is pushing the banks to not misbehave at a time like that. And probably an additional layer of protection that people didn't have in 2008, 2009.
Yeah, we keep talking about politics, but the level of accountability is pretty shocking. And one of the things that I'm getting frustrated with at the moment is the utilities. I mean, people in the UK feel we don't have any monopolies. That's a thing of the past. It is not. You try and get a gas connection and a competitive price. You try and get an internet or a phone connection without going through one company, effectively, Openreach. You try and do your water and negotiate on water. You can't. You try and negotiate on the size of your meter in your building. Oh, no, you can't do that. You can only increase the size, you know. It's just frustrating, and you think to yourself, well, actually, who's in control here? It's as though that's been forgotten about. But that's my little bit of my high horse, right? Yeah. So anyway, so looking forward, what's your investing criteria going forward, Danny? Has anything changed, or is business as usual?
Yeah, longer term view on stuff, probably more secure tenancy profiles in some respects. There would have been some stock that we might have taken a bit of an educated punt on where we think there's demand, but we're taking a little bit of a punt on where the demand is. We're doing a little bit less than that, maybe, than we would have. But no, principally the same. You know, ultimately, primarily, I believe in the longevity of UK property over any other investment vehicle that there is. So I can't make a liar of myself slowing down because there's a bit of noise out there. Lending's it's not challenging, but getting good service from a lender is becoming increasingly getting good service from anyone. Sorry, and again, this is a high horse thing, but getting good service from anyone in the UK is difficult at the moment because there's no leverage for employers at the minute. There's more jobs than there is people, and people, if they don't enjoy the job currently, they can just skip to another job and away we go and we start again. So yeah, the economy's in a tough place at the moment for viability of some things. You know, cost of materials has to come down at some point. Cost of building and construction, that has to come down at some point, because otherwise it hits an equilibrium point where it makes no sense to build anymore.
Yep.
But because we're so supply and demand driven, and there's so much demand for labour and a lack of supply of it, at the minute they're dictating to us a little bit, aren't they?
Sure. And that is really difficult. Yeah. And it's a standard excuse, but in, you know, I say excuse, but as an example, we've got a restaurant and it's not an excuse. Trying to get chefs is almost impossible, you know, and so you've got to cut your cloth accordingly and you have to operate within your means. It's really challenging in some of these markets right now. Danny, if you were starting out again now, and I know you do a lot of work with investors. So what would be your sort of top three tips right now for someone getting started? And I appreciate people coming from different backgrounds. Some have got money, some haven't, you know. But a typical investor is maybe a bit younger. They're looking at getting started in the market. They got a little bit of money. They're not quite sure what to do with it, but they're looking at property. What's your kind of tips?
Number one, take the long-term view and ignore the noise, basically. or listen to relevant noise. I think it is that noisy out there on the news, on social media, that sometimes people don't know who they should listen to or what they should listen to or what is relevant. So emotion, not logic, is always the thing that, sorry, logic, not emotion, is always the thing I try and drive into people. So long-term view and be unemotional about investment, because ultimately the investment doesn't really care about your emotions. It cares about the market and the reality of the market. Ignore the noise and hype is probably another one. Don't put the money on a pedestal. Like, so many people get into property thinking money is the difficult thing. Money is the easiest part of property, and I'm aware that this is a easy hindsight statement to make 14 years in, but believe me, I spent far too long at the start thinking money was the important thing and undervaluing the deals. If you have control of a deal and you have the knowledge of what can be done with it, that has so much more value than money in this market and in any market, to be honest, but especially in this market, because money is more abundant than quality stock in this market. Definitely focus more energy on finding quality deals than worrying about not having the money to do anything with the quality deal. I think that's the main thing.
Okay. What about, I'm just going to touch on it briefly because we could go down a rabbit hole here, right? What about education?
Listen, I'm a massive believer in education. I'm a product of an education system that actually was good at the time but became outdated very quickly. And I think that you know, property education as a whole, that was the problem that happened. When we, potentially I'm speaking for you, but when I got into it in 2008, 2009, the internet wasn't what it is now by the level of information availability, free availability. Social media wasn't anything like it was, you know, technology wasn't anything like it was. You couldn't meet with, we couldn't do this. Like, we wouldn't have been doing this in 2008. I'd driven to you in Scotland, or it couldn't have happened when I was in Dubai or whatever it may be.
And we wouldn't have been doing it because it's a podcast.
Exactly. Yeah. But we've come so far on all of that, social media, marketing, information. You know, we're now in an information era. When I did it in 2008, 2009, it was a bit of a secret sauce, and you had to pay the money to get the secret sauce or work with somebody who was doing it, but you didn't really know anyone locally because no one was on social media or no one was marketing themselves. So, you know, in 2008, 2009, I have no resentment over what was paid for my training. And the problem I had was I got to about 2015, 2016 and started to see the change. I started to go, wait a minute. Like, people don't need to pay 20, 25 grand anymore to get that information. And actually, it's not the information they need anymore because they can get that. Like, you can piece, it's not easy, but you can piece it together, a lot of information through trial and error, speaking to the right people, blah, blah, blah. Actually, people now just need direction, a bit of accountability, a network, support, and like updates effectively on what is relevant in the market. And about 2015, 2016, I started to step back from the education world because I was thinking, and you know what it's like in the education world. If you've been to Tenerife, he's been to 11 Arif, and everybody's all of a sudden like fighting off to stay on top of the pedestal. I've done 100 million this year. I've done 100 million. And actually the lies got bigger because the sale had to get harder. I never ever thought it was a sinister thing. I just thought that what happened was the sell got harder because it had to be harder to justify people paying 20 grand. And then people started to create stories around the sale, and then it became a monster that was just so wrong that at that point I just started to step back and became a lot less comfortable with it. I think it's going into a good space now. What you're doing, what we're trying to do, I think, you know, giving people volume of value. People are willing to pay for value and network and support and accountability. They're willing to pay. Just don't need to pay tens of thousands anymore because it's abundant everywhere.
Yeah, and there's the ability to do more. There's the ability to do more one to many. Yeah. Whereas, you know, can't think of the word, but basically, you're able to reach so many more people with the same information for the same amount of time. input from yourself. And the only thing
we call it, we call it Netflix versus Blockbuster. That was our approach when we started our education program. It was back in the day, it was Blockbuster. You pay once, you get to use it once. You know, you need to remember as much of it as possible. And if you want to go again, you're going to have to pay again. Whereas now Netflix obviously goes, here's everything you need. We're going to get rid of it in volume and we're going to offer it in volume. It's great value. Watch it as many times as you want at your own speed, in your own comfort, in your own home. And that's the way the world's gone. The world's moved to subscription. There's no doubt about it.
Danny, just remind us, I'll pop in the show notes, just remind us what your network is called.
Prosperity Network. So very much like probably what we've presented here. No hype. No bullshit. I mean, we have a no knobhead rule. If you come in and you're a knobhead, you're going to get kicked out very quickly. Like we just don't. I've always believed in environment and networks. It served me really well, spending a lot of my time networking. Because everyone, it's always that thing in property, isn't it? Oh, if you're doing so well in property, why do you want to tell other people? And why do you want to share anything? And those who can't do teach, and it's like, oh, mate, have a minute. Like, think about it logically. If I can train 1,000 people on the type of properties I would buy, who do you think they're going to come and bring properties to? You can create the ultimate win-win without ripping them off. As long as your intent is good, you're giving them value, they're going to progress themselves. I've raised money, I've had introductions to deals, there's all sorts that I've done over the years just through the power of network. It makes your life so much easier. I think there's this massive scarcity mindset in the property world sometimes that absolutely baffles me, like, because I know based on my experience how well I've done out of it.
Fantastic, Danny, that's been superb, thank you. There's lots of other things I'd like to talk about, but I think we probably should draw a line there. It's been super. I'm going to pop that in the show notes. If anyone wants to reach out to Danny, we'll put some contact details there in the show notes for that. So thanks very much, Danny.
Pleasure.
Hi there. I hope you're enjoying the content delivered on the CPI podcast. Even though it's free to listen to, it actually takes quite a bit of time and financial commitment to deliver each and every episode. Did you know that by leaving a positive written review, you, yes, you, will have a direct impact on the visibility of the podcast? And that's really important, because by reaching a wider audience, it helps our team to continually improve the overall content that we deliver to you week after week. For some of you, leaving a review will be second nature, but for others, it might be a first one. Open your podcast app, pick the CPI podcast and search for previous reviews. And on iTunes in particular, click to look at all of the reviews and then you'll see an option to leave a written review. Go on, it'll only take 2 minutes and it'll really make our day. And we genuinely read every single one of them.